You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Let's count some of the ongoing wars of conquest: Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine. Now the war makers are pushing for a new war to conquer Iran. And off in the wings, there is a growing, well-organized clamor for a war of intervention in Sudan. Here the rationale is not weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons. In this case, the rationale is a humanitarian war. The precise language is a doctrine in which Canadians have had an important role in developing, Canadians like Lloyd Axworthy and Michael Ignatieff. It's the doctrine of the responsibility to protect. This doctrine is designed to supplant a principle long established in international law, the principle of the sovereignty of nations. To explore the differences between the sovereignty of nations and the responsibility to protect, I'm joined by David Jacobs. He is a Toronto lawyer specializing in international law and human rights law. Good afternoon, David, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Hello, yes, good to be here.
What historical experiences led the United Nations to place emphasis on the inviolability of the sovereignty of nations?
Well, the sovereignty of nations actually is a legal concept which has been around for quite a long time. But really after World War II, it gained a tremendous set of teeth, so to speak, if I can use that as a metaphor, by being married to the idea of the sovereign equality of nations, not just the sovereignty, but the legal equality of nations, and a prohibition against war. That's all encapsulated in the United Nations Charter, and came about, obviously, as a result of the defeat of the Nazis, and of the defeat of the concept of the legitimacy of aggressive war or wars of aggression. And certainly when we're talking about the situation in Sudan, where there's a tremendous ongoing attempt by the United States and others to whip up support for violent military intervention in Iraq, in Sudan, if you go back to the history, the pre-World War II history, of course, when the Nazis and the Italian fascists started to invade other countries, they didn't do so by telling their own populations that they were conducting these invasions because they wanted to grab wealth or grab oil or become the commanders of the world. They told their own populations they were doing so for humanitarian reasons, because they had, in the current parlance, the responsibility to protect. The Nazis told the German people in 38-39 that they had the responsibility to protect the Sudeten Germans, who were being mistreated, particularly women were being raped and so on by people in Czechoslovakia. And similarly in Poland, they were going to protect people from the depredations of the Poles, who were committing atrocities. And again, when Mussolini invaded Africa, he did so by telling the Italians that he was going there to free the slaves. So when the United Nations and international lawyers looked at this in the context of the Nuremberg trials and so on, came to a number of conclusions. One, that if you looked at the world of war crimes, the supreme war crime was the crime of commencing an aggressive war, a war contrary to international treaties, and that all other war crimes, crimes against the peace, crimes against humanity, and war crimes were subsumed within that, that the entire evil of the whole was contained in crimes against the peace. I mention this for a couple of reasons, because with the coming of the responsibility to protect goes the receding of the importance of the concept of crimes against the peace. So when the U.S. attacks Afghanistan in what is clearly a war of aggression contrary to international treaties, when it attacks Iraq contrary to international treaties, when it's preparing to attack Iran, when it attacked all of the countries it's attacked in the last number of years, that is, according to Nuremberg, the supreme war crime. But nobody talks, of course, about prosecuting the United States or dealing with that war crime. What is talked about instead is we set up international criminal courts and ad hoc criminal courts and so on, who have no jurisdiction. None of the international criminal courts have jurisdiction to prosecute crimes against the peace. So the international community and international lawyers said, look, you can't use as an excuse for war humanitarian intervention. Every tyrant, every dictator, every warmonger is bound to say that they are invading a foreign country because that foreign country is intrinsically bad. It's evil. It's committing crimes against its own people. It's violent. It's genocidal. It's got weapons of mass destruction. It's, you list your excuses. But at the end of World War II, the world came together in the United Nations and said, no, we're going to end the scourge of war. And after the creation of the United Nations, the member states of the United Nations committed to each other and to the Charter that they would not engage in war to enforce their, to settle their disputes, and that war could only be legitimate in two circumstances. One, in national self-defense, narrowly defined, that is, your nation is on the verge of being attacked by a foreign nation, there are troops ready to pour across your borders. You can, of course, use force to defend yourself as a nation. And two, if there is a threat to international peace and security, which can be dealt with by no other means after all peaceful means have been exhausted. And peaceful means, for those of your listeners who are trade unionists, for example, would include the mediation, arbitration, leading up to international protests, boycotts, and so on and so. And at the last resort, the military committee of the United Nations would be struck, and there could be armed force to stop a threat to international peace and security. What we now have, with the unfortunate blessing of the Canadian government and so on, is a tremendous expansion, a whole new cause of war, the responsibility to protect, which contains within it all of the dangers which the United Nations and international lawyers saw at the end of World War II. You can't allow one nation to claim there's a humanitarian crisis in another nation which will allow it to invade. For all kinds of reasons, it's too dangerous, and international law has eschewed, up until now, humanitarian intervention as a proper cause of war.
Has there been a case, let's say, before the World Court where there was an argument, one side arguing their intervention was validated by a responsibility to protect, and the other side that was being attacked used the argument of their right to sovereignty?
Yes, in fact, there has, and it's been quite accepted in international law that attack another country claiming humanitarian reasons is a crime against the peace and a violation of international law. And the key case on this, and there are more than one, is the Nicaragua case. The United States armed contra forces in Honduras and Nicaragua and mined the harbors of Nicaragua. The United States claimed, as one of its defenses, that it was doing so for humanitarian reasons, and it was doing so to stop the atrocities of the Sandinistas. It had a number of other things which it said that Sandinista violence would spread up through Honduras into the United States. And anyway, the court resoundingly rejected that as a cause of war. They said even if it was true, it's not an appropriate cause of war, and it's a breach of the obligations of the United States under international law, which is to have peaceful resolution of disputes.
In your mind, would there be anything exceptional about the case of Darfur which would lead, either from the point of view of law or from the point of view of humanitarian concerns, to justify military intervention by foreign armies, whether they were under the flag of the United Nations, NATO, or one of the states of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent question. And again, I think you put it very well. You're talking about military intervention. And the words responsibility to protect are highly euphemistic. And they're used, I think, because the words humanitarian intervention have been so resoundingly rejected, although this is the same thing. Responsibility to protect, we should have no illusions about it. We're talking about war. And the responsibility to protect is invoked when the sovereign state is deemed by whoever is got such a responsibility or takes it on themselves not to be protecting its own people. So that's the argument about Sudan. The problem is, and there's a number of problems, just as we look quizzically at Hitler's comments about Sudetenland or Mussolini's comments about Abyssinia, you have to look quizzically at the propaganda that comes out of Sudan. That's the first problem. Do we really know what's happening there? Because we do know that the powerful nations in the world have powerful means of propaganda. And, you know, the United States and people like Elie Wiesel and actors like George Clooney are beating the drums telling us that there's a genocide going on in Sudan. Well, others such as the European Union and others have said today, well, they've studied it and there isn't. So who's telling the truth about what's happening in Sudan? That's the first problem. And we know, again, that one worries about, like the title of the Who song, Won't Get Fooled Again. The U.S. has in the past used propaganda to mislead people about what's happening in foreign countries. I mean, let's just take some recent examples. The weapons of mass destruction was the claim. We're going into Iraq. That's not legitimate under any reasons, but we're going into Iraq to deal with weapons of mass destruction. Well, we all know that wasn't true. It was a propaganda pretext. During the first Iraq war, there was a huge propaganda fuss made, if people recall, about Iraqi babies being thrown out of incubators, Kuwaiti babies being thrown out of incubators by Iraqi soldiers. This was completely fabricated by the U.S. Firm of Hill & Knowlton, but was accepted by such august organizations as Amnesty International. So the first question is, how do we know exactly what's happening? The second issue is if there is a humanitarian disaster and in Sudan, if there are refugees, what's causing it? And here's where the facts on the ground become really very, very troubling. We know, for example, there's a civil war. We know, for example, there are rebel groups, although they're hardly ever spoken about in the Western media. There are rebel groups engaging in civil war. Now, what's really troubling about the comments from people who are urging military intervention is why they aren't first saying, let's sit down around a peace table and resolve the situation in Darfur as between the combatants. Because one group of combatants, or more than one group of rebels, are not actually giving up their arms at this point in time and haven't come to the peace table. Now, I would speculate, I think it's reasonable speculation, that the reason why these rebel groups are continuing to prosecute the war with all that entails, including the inevitable refugee crisis, is because they're hearing from the United States and from elements of the United Nations that there will be military intervention. They know that the United States does not like the Sudanese government, would like to effect regime change there. After all, the U.S. illegally bombed a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan under the Clinton regime. So the more the rebel groups hear about the responsibility to protect, the more they're encouraged to continue the war, to continue killing aid workers, to continue killing civilians, to continue creating civilian chaos and nightmares, because they think that they are going to succeed with the assistance of foreign military intervention. In the guise of humanitarian intervention, in the guise of responsibility to protect, the Sudanese government will be, in their hopes, overthrown, and they'll come to power. Why should they give up their arms? The next thing that disturbs one about the George Clooney's and the people who claim to be have humanitarian goals is, why aren't they asking who's arming and training the rebels? Could it be that the United States is assisting in arming the rebels? Could it be that Israel is also? I mean, these are things which one appears in the press. Last thing, you would ask me whether this was an unusual situation, Darfur, calling for such things. There are refugee crises all over the world. I mean, you know, the famous one, I suppose, is that there are millions of Palestinian refugees who have had no solution to their problems since 1948 and 1967, respectively. There doesn't seem to be a big hurry for humanitarian intervention into Israel to resolve their problems, notwithstanding the breaches of international law by the Israeli government. But put that to one side, and let's just look around the world. Congo was a subject, is a continuing subject of an invasion from forces of the government of Rwanda. Such invasion has cost, according to United Nations figures, 3 million dead at least 6-7 years.
Thank you very much, David.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with David Jacobs. He's an international human rights lawyer in Toronto.